Okay. Everyone, we have to settle down for the next talk. Okay. We're succeeding in the friendly, amicable atmosphere and the friendly meetings with old and new friends. But we have to try to stick to this time schedule a little bit. Yeah, Hashem, I have those. Thanks. Okay. So, yeah. Okay. Let me just briefly introduce Dr. Robert Langley Smith. Bob, as he's known to me, will tell you a little bit more himself about his backgrounds for coming here. Will you also say about your work here, or should I do that?
I'll do that.
Okay. No, you'll do it. No, it's okay. No, I just want to. No, Bob worked at the as the head of the International Center for Consultancy Work at the Teacher Education Program, and also did a lot of work with us at the Master's Program, both in academic work with the students, supporting students writing their theses and so on and so forth, but also socially, very active in involving the students in social activities. And us in nice social interaction at work. So I'll give the floor now to Robert. Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much, Christine. It's so nice to be back here and seeing some familiar faces, including my next-door neighbor, Berit, which was a nice collision. Thank you for that. And other friends and colleagues. It's nice to be back. And thank you, Anas, for the invitation. It was very kind of you. My title I've diverted from a bit, but I hope you'll be with me. Also, I haven't prepared a PowerPoint, and I'll tell you why. I had to give a presentation at UNESCO in Paris some years back, which all depended upon a PowerPoint. And you can guess what happened. At the crucial moment, it or I failed. And there was this mass of people from Afghanistan to Zambia, in a great circle. You know, you've seen pictures of that kind of thing. And I was supposed to present the findings of a group from the UN Girls Education Initiative, and I found that the contraption didn't work. And there was nobody in the building who could fix it. So I had to just speak from my notes and hope that people will be able to follow it. Fortunately, of course, this morning we are conducting proceedings in God's first language, so you can all... I'm sorry. Yeah, I can't get away with that one too often. But seriously, what I want to present to you, and I hope I can stick to time. I don't normally, but I'll do my best. What I want to do, particularly for the students amongst you, make the presentation in terms of encouraging you to ask questions. I think that's what this higher level study is all about. Perhaps even to try to answer some of those questions, but generating questions about what somebody already referred to as the sort of received knowledge and the status quo. Generating questions is what the whole intellectual exercise should be about, and then attempting to address them. So I will be talking about EFA, Education for All. I'm very glad that my former colleague Olaf Seim is here from NORAD, formerly Foreign Affairs. We worked together closely on some of these issues in the past, and I'll be bringing some of that experience into this talk. I've called it Viewing Education for All Through a Gender Lens. I've gone a bit further than that, and what I'm going to be saying is that we should look at things like the Millennium Development Goals and their successors, the Sustainable Development Goals, through the same lens. Whichever way we look at these development issues, we need some kind of lens to look through. And as we heard from Ingvild, she looked through a particular lens at the issue of marketization of education. So finding that lens and giving a clear view of whatever the issue may be is very important. But let me start with a little story which will illustrate what I want to talk about. An elderly couple came into McDonald's. I'm sure you're familiar with McDonald's. And the husband went to the counter and he ordered one hamburger, one pack of fries, one cup of coffee, like Ellen is guzzling at present, and one apple pie. And then the couple sat down and the husband carefully divided the burger into two equal halves. Then he counted out the French fries, one for you, one for me, one for you, absolutely equal. He cut the apple pie in half, exactly equal halves. And then he drank half the coffee and put the cup down and tucked into his half of the burger and the French fries and the apple. And the staff were watching all this with some fascination until one of them went across and said to them, "Excuse me, I've seen what you're doing here. You've only ordered one meal. You've very carefully divided it in half like this. You, sir, have eaten your half. You, madam, haven't touched anything. What is going on here?" And so the wife said, "Well, from when we were first married many years ago, we decided we would share everything equally, absolutely equal. We share everything. There's no male thing, no female thing. We share everything equally." So the staff member said, "Well, I understand that, but why is it that you have not eaten your half?" And she said, "Well, I'm waiting for our false teeth." It's not a true story. Don't be too disgusted. But I'm doing that to soften you up a bit, of course, but also this business of equity, equality, whatever term we want to use, is at the heart of what I want to talk about. But let me start with something a little bit more serious. And this is a long quotation from a man called George Monbiot, who is a Guardian journalist. And he's talking about the way in which we are living in the wealthy West. He says, "There's nothing they need." He's thinking about Christmas coming. "Nothing they don't own already. Nothing they even want. So you buy them a solar-powered waving doll. A belly button brush. An hilarious inflatable Zimmer frame." What do you call it in Norwegian? Is it a Zimmer frame? One of those frames that, you know, people walk with. Yeah. But imagine an inflatable one. Right? Okay. "These things seem amusing on the first day of Christmas, silly on the second, embarrassing on the third. By the 12th day of Christmas, they're in with the junk. For 30 seconds of dubious entertainment, we commission the use of materials whose impacts will ramify for generations." Researching her film, The Story of Stuff, Annie Leonard discovered that of the materials flowing through the consumer economy, only 1% remain in use 6 months after sale. The stupidity of the products is matched by the profundity of the impact. Rare materials, complex electronics, the energy needed for manufacture and transport are extracted and refined and combined into compounds of utter pointlessness. This is pathological consumption, a world-consuming epidemic of collective madness. Now, George Monbiot is a professional, grumpy old man, all right? So he's a bit extreme in some of his views. But he's a very influential writer, and he illustrates the discredited economic model which lies at the heart of the Millennium Development Goals and, I'm afraid, the Sustainable Development Goals movement. The question to be addressed is this: is our development agenda to be dominated by outdated and potentially dangerous strategies like industrialization and consumption, or is a rights-based and more human approach more likely to provide a dividend? I'm going to argue that although goals are helpful, they are not solutions if they deal with the world in a skewed and ineffective way. It's been calculated, for example, that to reach the sustainable development goals as they're formulated would take $2 to $3 trillion US dollars a year, take 207 years to achieve, and require the world economy to increase by a factor of 175. And we're confronted with global warming, climate change, and over-extraction and consumption of all sorts of fossil fuels and the rest. So J.P. Nayak, an Indian educator, said in a different context many years ago, we have no alternative to alternatives. So the Millennium Development Goals had as their aim the achievement of specific targets regarding poverty, education, gender equality, health, environmental stability, and all the rest of it that you're familiar with, I'm sure. The goals are much criticized as being top-down rather than actual policy statements. Now, if we define policy as a course of action that you actually believe can be achieved and are viable, then all the MDGs were sadly at fault, and I'm afraid that the Sustainable Development Goals suffer from the same criticism. However, the most you could hope for is that some measure of progress would be made. And as I'll point out in a little while, a good deal of progress was in fact made. But you can't announce to the world, we have these goals and we hope we're going to get some of them. You have to be definitive about it, but it is problematic. So, huge strides were made, not least in the education for all field. Goal two was to achieve universal primary education. But herein lies part of the problem. Were people talking about universal enrollment, universal attendance, or universal completion of primary education or basic education? And what about the question of whether what they learnt at school, as we were looking at earlier, was any good to them, in effect? So, major gains were made in reducing poverty and so on, in slowing down the advance of HIV/AIDS, but at the end of the process, Ban Ki-moon was minded to state broken promises, unmet commitments, lack of interest in sustainable development. And H.L. Mencken said complex problems had simple, easy to understand, but wrong answers. Of course, the process of developing the Millennium Development Goals was a technocratic one based on neoliberalism and globalization, which we've heard a bit about already. Okay, the MDGs should have been signposts or indicators, not goals. Where did goals concerning peace, democracy, human rights, security and disarmament go? What happened to them? What was watered down by interest groups? And we have to ask questions about the processes of the Millennium Development Goals and the Sustainable Development Goals. And they have to be examined in at least three dimensions. What I've called the hardware of the goals, that is the financing particularly, the software, the actual programs for development, and most importantly, the underwear. By the underwear, I mean, what is this ideology which is driving what is going on? Was there a common cross-sectoral view of synergies and interconnectedness? Nation states played no part in the construction of the Millennium Development Goals. So how could they be expected to own the program? Why was $1 a day set as the benchmark for measuring poverty when everybody knows that it should be much higher, maybe $5 a day? Why were specific human and political rights missing from the MDGs? Climate change was unmentioned. And whose interests were reflected in this omission? We see what Donald Trump has been up to in terms of reneging on deals and agreements to do with climate change and so on. Perhaps one of the biggest problems were associated with what I've called the let there be light syndrome. Those of you familiar with the book of Genesis know that God said, let there be light, and there was light. And too much to do with the goal setting was let this happen without there being any strategies or financing to make it happen. Of course, the great agencies were there to monitor and report on progress, as with the annual global monitoring reports on progress with education for all. But otherwise, it seemed sufficient to prescribe a program to declare that no country would be denied the finance to get what they wanted and then hand it down for implementation. All of this, of course, resulted in a reaction. And I don't want to underemphasize the progress that was made and the good work that was carried out under the old deal of the Millennium Development Goals. There was good progress made in many aspects, but far short of what had been hoped for, which was why Ban Ki-moon was so negative about it all. So there were reactions. As I say, progress was made in many areas, but statements like the Common African Position, which was a very useful document, with its emphasis on people-centred development rather than highways and hotels, homegrown and supported innovation, environmental stability, and participatory rather than technocratic solutions, and the integration of authentic grassroots voices would lead to a more realistic and manageable approach to development. This struck a chord with me when we were talking a moment ago about home knowledge, and that's what the Common African Position embraced to a large extent. I was interested to hear about the little boy who said to his mother, "Mummy, why are there so many people in the world? There are people everywhere. Everywhere you go, there are people, people, people. Where did they all come from?" His mother said, "Well, you know the story of Adam and Eve in the Bible. Well, Adam and Eve had babies, and then later their babies had more babies, and later their babies had even more babies. And so it went on until there were all the people that you see today." So the little boy said, "Oh, but Daddy said we were descended from the monkeys." So his mother said, "Oh, well, he was talking about his side of the family." So you imagine, it's a good one, that, isn't it? Yes. Write it down, use it. There's an example for you of home knowledge, okay, and something that should not be ignored and neglected. So what I'm going on now to talk about is the need for a new way of looking at the issues that I've just mentioned. What do we do about development? If setting goals is okay but a bit unrealistic, if we don't have the means of actually achieving those goals, what can we do instead? How can we focus down and make the thing more manageable? And this is where I feel that this gender orientation has to come into it. I'm sorry, I apologize for only being a man, but gender covers both sorts of people. All right? Please bear that in mind, okay? I have a wonderful daughter-in-law who's very active in ensuring that her father-in-law is gender-sensitive. All right? All right. Out of these sort of discussions and reactions to the MDGs came similar reactions around the world, came the Sustainable Development Goals, the 17 goals that were laid out. There is a saying in English that if you are really satisfied with something, you will say three cheers for, or three cheers for Brexit, for example. I'm not sure if everyone is familiar with that term, but this is Britain leaving the European Union. It is the biggest issue, apart from the scandals associated with our politicians, one of whom was referred to as a safe pair of hands. The trouble is he couldn't keep his hands in his pockets, so he got the sack. Justifiably enough. But we say things like three cheers for Brexit. Looking at the Sustainable Development Goals or something else which we're not fully on board with, we might say two and a half cheers or two cheers for this and that. So that's the situation I think we're in. Thus, with the SDGs, maybe two cheers. On the face of it, they're a major step forward. At least they are more participatory than the Millennium Development Goals were. And they seem to cover everything in a liberal Western mindset. The first six goals echo the old MDGs, and the missing elements of climate change, peace and justice and so on are all there. But if we use our analytic tool of looking at the hardware, the software and the underwear, we find that these sustainable goals, allegedly sustainable, may not be as sustainable as we thought. Now, the very respected journal, The Economist, really climbs into the Sustainable Development Goals with quite a vicious attack upon them. It says they are sprawling and misconceived. They are unfeasibly expensive. Remember the figure I gave you of $2 to $3 trillion US dollars a year to achieve them. And a betrayal of the world's poorest people. Going even further, they say that actually they're a high school wish list for how to save the world. It's a bit like the Miss Universe competition. I've never watched it, but Anders told me all about it. And two interesting things come out of this. It's called Miss Universe, but the winner is always someone from this planet. I don't quite understand that. But secondly, the winner always is asked what she plans to do now that she has won this wonderful title. And she says, I'd like to work for world peace. You know? So she's standing there in a bikini saying, I want to work for world peace. Some things are too bizarre to even imagine. But where was I? Okay. So a wish list, like this unrealistic sort of statement we get from these people. Defenders of the Sustainable Development Goals, and there are plenty, argue that there was an inclusive process. It was not just the technocrats in some 15th floor office somewhere, but real people were consulted. In an article by a man called Jason Hickel, which is called The Problem with Saving the World, and I'll make sure that you can have these references should you need them, he points to a serious contradiction within the Sustainable Development Goals. He notes that in the preamble it states that planet Earth and its ecosystems are our home, and achieving harmony with nature is a necessity. However, at the core of the Sustainable Development Goals is a program for development and poverty reduction based on the old model of basing development on industrial growth, extraction, production, and consumption. An annual growth figure of at least 7% is posited, but most of the consumption referred to is by the already wealthy. The poorest 60% of humanity received only 5% of GDP globally between 1999 and 2008. To eliminate global poverty on the SDG model, as I said earlier, would take 207 years. I know that I personally won't be here to see that, and neither will many of you. So, the current view of the SDGs is that it is hoped that wealth will trickle down to the poorest. Some of you may remember Mrs. Thatcher, who was a British Prime Minister a few years back. She took it upon herself to address the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland. Now, the Church of Scotland is slightly more conservative than the Lutheran Church, which some of you will be familiar with. But anyway, Mrs. Thatcher was invited to address them. And she took as her text for her address the story of the Good Samaritan. For those of you who don't know it, briefly, a man is beaten up by thieves. All kinds of reliable people, like priests and so on, pass by because they're busy or they can't be bothered to rescue this man who's been beaten up. Along comes a brown person, shall we say, all right, an out person. And he looks at this beaten-up character and he tends his wounds, takes him to a guest house, pays for his stay there, and goes on his way quietly. And Mrs. Thatcher had the effrontery to say, the Good Samaritan who rescued this poor beaten-up character was only able to do this because he had generated enough wealth to pay for the bill at the hotel. Now, you can imagine the reaction of the people of the Church of Scotland and the rest of us anyway, was what kind of hubris, what kind of pride and ego trip is this? Why did I bring that into the discussion? Mainly because I don't like Mrs. Thatcher, but no. Anyway, the idea of wealth trickling down was the point, and it has never worked anywhere, I'm afraid. In Scandinavia, of course, you've had a welfare state for many, many years where the poorest and the disadvantaged have, largely speaking, been looked after in a much better way than happens, say, in Donald Trump's America. But the idea of wealth trickling down, it doesn't happen, it doesn't work. As I said earlier, setting the benchmark for poverty at $1.25 a day in the SDGs is totally unrealistic. Nobody manages to live on a figure like that. The Economist argues that poverty is a function of extreme wealth accumulation and overconsumption by the few at the expense of the poor. So the SDGs are silent on regulation of financial markets and tax evasion and avoidance, which drains poor countries of $1.7 trillion a year, are sidestepped. So it's a sad story. And what Hickel goes on to say is this: we need to tackle the irrationality of endless growth head on. pointing out that capitalist growth, as measured by GDP, is not the solution to poverty, but it is the primary cause. I've got here a book that I'm going to leave with Anders for inclusion in your library. It's called Prosperity Without Growth. And the argument of Tim Jackson is it is possible for a nation to prosper and to overcome poverty without this massive industrial and commercial growth, which is threatening the West in many kinds of ways. So he argues that development is essential for poorer nations, but that people can flourish without stuff, without possessions, without kit of one sort or another. I wonder how many of us have to have the latest iPhone. I've had to queue up overnight to make sure that they didn't miss out on buying the latest one, even though the previous one is fine. Coming to Stockholm earlier in the year to celebrate with Elin and others at her Doctor of Defence, on the metro tube trick, no, T-Bana in Stockholm, everybody except that man over there and myself was on a smartphone the whole time. Nobody was reading a book. Nobody was talking to each other. And yet they will all queue up. Oh, it's in Sweden, so I can talk about them freely. They will all queue up to buy the latest gadget. We have to ask ourselves, do we really need these things? And we're in a trap, in a way, of people creating needs and wants rather than needs that we respond to much too easily. And what Jackson is talking about is overcoming that so that we can get back to a simpler way of life and one where prosperity is possible without all this growth. And much of his analysis concerns how industrialized nations can get their house in order. Now, I'm coming to my point after all of this, you'll be pleased to know. Inequality lies at the heart of most of the development issues we are now concerned with. This might have been an alternative lens through which to look at EFA. We could have looked at these goals and the things associated with them through an inequality lens or through a lens of peace and security, health and reproductive rights. I was listening to a presentation by a woman from the UN Population Fund in which she was arguing that women with so many children and often no husband, no man around, they've gone off to do something else, is one of the contributory factors to insecurity and conflict because people become desperately poor in those situations and then they try to do something about it, which may involve protest, violence, all kinds of extremes. The point I'm getting towards is that great gender inequality lies at the root of all of the things that I've mentioned. If we're talking about peace and security even, if we're talking about poverty, if we're talking about health issues, all the people at the bottom of the heap are always the women and the girls. So what are the possibilities for a better outcome and a plan for action? I worked for a while, as I said, with the UN Girls Education Initiative. Norway took a leading part with managing that program. And what we did each year was to critique the global monitoring report on progress with EFA from a gender perspective. What were they doing in Education for All that affected directly women and girls? And we found that we felt there was insufficient focus on the gender issue. People like Olaf, who were deeply involved with that in UNESCO at the time, said, OK, we understand what you're saying, but we're trying to mainstream these issues, not highlight and flag them all the time, but make sure that they are there and it's understood that they are there. But Udgai's analysis included calling for greater political will to redress gender imbalances and getting the funding mechanisms right, so that we could get the whole issue of girls' education right in the forefront, which we felt it lacked. Now, why do girls not go to school? I'm generalizing very broadly here. And there are 8 P's which are associated with this. I'll run through them very quickly. They don't go to school, obviously, because of poverty. You can't pay school fees, can't buy books, can't get uniforms and so on. The second P I've got is parental attitudes, associated often with the culture. There's a saying in Pakistan that if you send a girl to school, you are fattening a chicken for somebody else's table. In other words, somebody else gets the benefit when that girl marries and not your own family. Another big issue is the proximity of the school. How far away is it for a girl to go? Is it safe for her to walk a long way? And what about the program offered at the school? Too much boy-oriented, not sufficient recognition of girls' needs, which relates to the provision at the school. Are there suitable toilets and washing facilities and whatnot? Those things keep girls out of school. The personnel. Are there female teachers, role models, who can have a pastoral duty with the girls as well? What about planning? Going up and up the levels, are gender needs at the front and centre of ministry policies? Which brings us to that one of policy. Is there, as in Uganda, a minister for women who is a champion of these sorts of issues? And do policies conform to the test of, is it doable, is it viable, is it possible to implement? So these are issues that are well known. We don't have to need a great deal of research about them. But while I was here working with Anders and particularly with Ellen, we had a lot to do with another of Olaf Syme's children, which was called the NETF, the Norwegian Education Trust Fund. And this was a fund put together to help countries furthest behind with education for all to get their planning and the basic policy documents in place. It wasn't to fund getting kids into school, but it was to put the scaffolding, if you like, in place so that governments could manage on a proper planned basis. And the trust fund, over its lifetime, I think, was extremely successful. And it provided easy access for governments to get funding quickly. It benefited from the fact that some Norwegians were in critical positions in the bank, particularly Professor Lauglu from the university and Birger Fredriksen. Very quick story about Birger. He comes from the north of Norway originally, and those people have a certain reputation in Norwegian culture, if you're from Finnmark. And I told him a story about the chief of police in Oslo doing a tour of inspection over the weekend, and he found three corpses in the mortuary at the police headquarters, three dead bodies, and each of them had a huge smile on its face, so they were dead. And so he said to the officer in charge, "What is this all about?" And the officer said, "Oh, well, this one is a Scotsman who was visiting Oslo. He went to the brewery, fell in a tank of beer, unfortunately drowned, but drowned very happily. So said, "Well, what about this one?" So this was a man from France, and he was here, spent the weekend in a hotel with his lover, but unfortunately he died during the festivities, but he died with a big smile on his face. "Ooh, what about this third one?" "Oh, he's from Finnmark, and he was struck by lightning." And so the police chief said, "But why has he got a big smile on his face?" And so the officer said, "Well, I told you he was from Finnmark. When he was struck by lightning, he thought he was having his photograph taken." So Birger was a key person in that trust fund. I'm going to finish now, okay? What I'm going to say, and I'm glad Olaf is here, because I'm going to suggest that Norway has a role to play in addressing the issue of gender equity and equality in development, particularly in the field of education. I would like to see another Norwegian trust fund set up, whether it works through the bank or through some other agency, and it does exactly what that earlier trust fund did. It gets governments together to develop plans, to develop policies, regional cooperation, lots of technical work on what we called country status reports, in fact, researching what was the real life on the ground situation in each country. What were the real barriers? Were they amongst my eight P's, or were there more P's that I haven't even found or thought of? But doing that basic platform scaffolding work, Norway could play a huge role in doing that, in putting together a trust fund that would finance this sort of thing, targeted maybe to only a handful of countries. But I think until we get this right, until we get these gender issues overcome, then our development progress is going to be held back. Let me finish then by this final quotation from Tim Jackson. He says, the starting point of his analysis lies in the vision of prosperity as the ability to flourish as human beings within the ecological limits of a finite planet. Not an industrialized wasteland filled with wage slaves, consuming and dumping, consuming and dumping. The deep contradiction at the heart of the Sustainable Development Goals needs to be balanced by a more human perspective, where we reach out to the poorest, the least advantaged, the marginalized. They are the women and girls of the South. No longer let there be light, but let them flourish, and here is our help in bringing that about. Okay, thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you so much, Bob, for your talk. We are going to get Ellen set up with her with the computer. Do you need? Are you connected?
Oh nej, nu er det jo ikke. Nu er det ikke nogen, som gjorde det så fort. Den er så god på her. Her skulle ret på toppen. Men sådan er det. En teknisk hjælp, som ikke fungerer. Kommer det på nu da? Hvordan ser det ud nu?
Det er
ikke, at hun
bare
trykker på. Ja, det er det. Men det blev lidt rotet på her. Er det jo noget?
Good morning. Do you hear me? Is it okay now? Does it work? Okay. Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Bob. You can probably all of you understand how great it was to work with that gorgeous man for, let's say, 10 years, hand in hand with the work within the master program. So it was many lessons learned and many good laughters and places and experiences. So thank you, Bob. I also appreciate that you kind of started talking about the dilemmas about the big goals that we have been living with since 1990, at least by written strategies and goals and objectives. As you also briefly mentioned, my dissertation wasn't defended until last year. It's a long, long time kind of a hobby that was stretched out, I would say. But anyway, so it reflects work in the Global South, specifically in Zambia. And as also was mentioned, HIV/AIDS was a focus for one of Anish and our programs. And that was also when I started working in Zambia, jointly with Bob. And the HIV/AIDS epidemic was on its peak, around 2000, 98, something like that. So that was the big issue, and that was what people were talking about, and that was what had to be mitigated, both from a national perspective, economic perspective, health perspective. People were dying, so either impacted or infected was kind of the sayings. So that was what faced us. And for about, just for you to see where Zambia is located in Africa. So for about 10 years I was working there. First with the sector program, where HIV/AIDS was the main component in the new reform strategy that was finally developed. Donors, the national minister, other actors, province, district level, schools. But you can also see the small the map of Zambia there, which says something about the infection rate. I don't know whether it's easy for you to read it, because I know it's a bit blurred maybe, but the arrow goes to southern province, where the infection rate was around 20 when we started, specifically in the urban areas, Livingston. And gradually a bit less out. Lusaka had equally high infection rates. So the whole, you can just imagine, one out of five. That's tremendous. So HIV/AIDS was on the agenda, and I was engaged in it, as everybody else, and got a specific task by the Ministry of Education to work with HIV/AIDS within the teacher training programs in Livingston, and got to know fairly well what is the situation, because the teachers there were also worried, and they also had a setup where this was the main target. So that was Livingston and the teacher training college. And just a couple of years after, I was asked to join the ministry to emphasize and implement, help them implement a new policy for HIV/AIDS implementation in schools, which was fairly kind of, among other African countries, Zambia was actually one of the first countries out with a proper comprehensive policy on these issues. But then to get it turned from policy to implementation and to actual action in schools, that was a big, big barrier. So it's not just to have the policy. It's not just to have the plan. But it has to be implemented, and that's through the school system, through the teachers, and those who are surrounding them. And the surroundings, just in brief, to say something about the project, it starts up with a small cluster, the first cohort, which was two districts, and we expanded gradually. So after four years, we had expanded to all provinces in Southern Province, about 900 schools, and quite a number of community schools in addition. So we started with a broad-based, multi-voiced planning, meaning that based upon the situation that we saw and realized and got to see through big baseline surveys in schools, among the community members, among the parents, the teachers, the NGOs and whatnot, we lifted up the policies, we lifted up the context, and found out that we need at least to do some kind of capacity building or training. What is the policy? Because people weren't even aware, right? But the policies are among the policymakers. At so many of these things doesn't even reach out to the schools. So those actually there to implement, they don't even know what they're supposed to implement. That's also a big problem, how the information don't go from the upper level and through the system. I shouldn't say it should go like from top to down. It should also, of course, go there. It's about how you make the policy, how you do the planning, as Bob was kind of touching upon. So based upon some sharing, some huge multi-voiced conferences and seminars where teachers, pupils, mothers, fathers, NGOs took part, local leaders and chiefs, we'll come back to that in a few seconds, we worked further, and a plan was established, which is then the training. It's the yellow one. And we then, after some time spent for implementation, we had a monitoring workshop. Back again, all the different stakeholders. What happened? So when the new cohort came in, we expanded the monitoring session and continued with the groundwork to inform and share and build up local strategies district-wise. District authorities, teachers, administrators, NGOs that was working there, etc., etc. So the monitoring sessions seemed to grow bigger and bigger, but it was also a learning session, right? Because they were meeting people across districts, across schools, and not just what happened within their local small unit. But thinking about the global situation as we have seen, 2003 was when we started. We had the MDGs already. We had the experiences from the EFA. So the whole global, the macro, the global level pushed forward efforts, initiatives, and plans for each country to follow. huge offices, huge amount of people, UNAIDS, right? And they had strategies, they had indicators, how many are infected, how many knows what the condom is, thousands of questions. You can just go in and search and find it. Are these questions, monetary indicators, relevant? Nobody asked anybody about relevance. Many of these questions were not at all relevant in the context that I was working. So what do we, how do we deal with it? Again, a very heavily top-down. It just illustrates a lot of these kind of global strategies. So we'll have to see now what happens with the SDGs. So if we then go to the local schools and to the people who are infected and suffering in the cultural rational, not the structural rational, they see their friends being sick. They know that you cannot talk about HIV/AIDS because that's stigmatized. It's taboos. It's lots of these things. So people are actually not able to talk because talking makes them stigmatized, outcasted. So how can you then come further with something which actually, with the disease that actually are being spread through sexual intercourse? We cannot talk about it. So what about the teachers then? They don't have teaching material. They don't have training. They are sitting there and they are supposed to teach. And they live in the communities where they are not supposed to talk. These are big dilemmas which has to be dealt with locally. It doesn't matter if you come with a suitcase or books from UNAIDS and ask about indicators. We are talking about people living in the community, socializing with each other, and living there according to their worldviews and their knowledge base. And this is just to illustrate. This is Mukuni village. You know it, Anne. We have been working together. Anne is now at Songdal. This is a small kind of piece of textile made by a grandmother in the Mukuni district. It illustrates the gender dimension. What are the girls doing or women doing? I got this small, small paper. It says, at the first, they are going to fetch water. At the second, they are going to meet guests. At the third, they are carrying grains, you know, this time. And then you see this women working, washing. Yeah. So it illustrates the life in the village and the work of the women. And this is just a glimpse into how people are living in their everyday lives. And that's where they cannot talk, but that's where they are infected. So what do? We cannot just leave these strategies in the hands of bureaucrats and external helpers whatsoever without always considering the need of the multi-voices, the people who are there to solve their own problems. So thinking then about Zambia, it could be Botswana, it could be any other African country. You have two parallel, basically, governing structures. The chiefs have been there since long before colonizing period. And they have a really legitimate power in their communities, in their villages. And in Zambia, as well as in Botswana and many other countries, the chiefs actually has a foundation in the constitution. Also in Zambia, the House of Chiefs in Lusaka, where they have an executive committee, core chiefs selected among 273 chief doms in Zambia. They have interzonal councils, and it goes all down to the zones, down to the chiefdom in each village. And the chief, I met many of them. Some of them had inherited the position as number 19. Others, like number 18, some places male chief, other chieftainess, ladies. And they were legitimate leaders in their local community. But they are not a part of the educational system, right? They are not a part of the structure that usually is the governing body, which is being contacted by UNAIDS, SDGs, MDGs, because they are outside. Although they are there, they have customary, soil, earth, some cost. They are there to keep the customs, the traditions, and the practices. But the practices and the how they work in the knowledge base is not necessarily a scientific Western knowledge base, which is kind of ruling, governing their worldviews. You can just take a small glimpse into just something, just for reference. But the knowledge that we might call indigenous or local knowledge, which has been raised earlier today, it's embedded in community and identity construction, inherited by the bigger family in a collective community, where the elderly has a certain position, the old female ladies dealing with initiation period to show and teach the girls how to behave. It's context sensitive, it's identity constructing. They get their identity through the work that is happening in their village, right? And it's a horizontal collaboration in a collective society, governed by the structures which are there. Okay, the other type of knowledge is more cognitive, established, linear. You can see it yourself, which is more abstract. We call it universal. That's why we can take these MOOCs, massive online courses, because education is kind of just very objective. It's just to take your exam. They send it to you from Oxford or they send it to you from Harvard. You just pay out, because knowledge is a kind of an abstract package. Like going back to root learning again, I would say, you know, you just copy a book. So this is more than the formal schooling. You just go to Zambia. This is one of the schools. I was there several times. I probably told you, my student, maybe I showed it to you yesterday. But you also have people sitting, working on tables in a proper university setting or a school which seems to be nicely... Or we are outside. Of course, that is... if it works, it could be. But that is a formal schooling where learning is supposed to take place based upon the cognitive educational structures, rules and regulations, right? We have curriculum, we have the books, we're supposed to pass the exams or we drop out if we don't. And it's totally kind of detached from the local village everyday life. Which is a big problem. And how do we then manage to convey HIV/AIDS education, for instance, since this is the case in this research? How can that be conveyed when people are stuck in their own contextual reality where it's taboo just to open up and you don't have any tools to deal with it? So since this was an 8-year long study, you may understand that there was a huge amount of data, and again, which lenses do you want to use? But I've already started indicating it, because when all that knowledge was there, accumulated in my computer, finally, I had to find some lenses to address the issues, at least some issues. Because there are so many issues one could start working with that it's kind of overwhelming. Policy, planning, you know, who knows, what, UNAIDS. So working a bit with these issues and moving around with the circles and the arrows and the dimensions, what I really felt, you know, my stomach feeling, something like that, what I really felt was interesting and was important was to... You know, of course, it's not just the books and the reports and everything is a part of this policy thing. You are sitting there with all this material and you are kind of lost. But then try to reorganize some of these circles and try to find some lenses and some perspectives. And of course, as I've started out, they are within two clusters of opposed kind of worldviews. One is the Western cognitive knowledge, which is what we somehow base our knowledge upon, which could be objective or not. Just, I'm not saying anything, just figure it out. And the other one is based upon the local conditions and the local reality in those communities that we are talking about. In this case, Zambia. So this is a cluster of interactive methodologies, you know, counseling, something. You can, it's not that interactive approach, strategies, stages, income-generating activities. We know these words from developmental activities. But over here you have sexual cleansing, households, traditional culture, extended families, witches, witchcraft, whatsoever, whatsoever. So that's a whole other cluster of words that characterize those two different dimensions. And the thing is, how do we manage to merge these things so that we can make sense of that the world we talk about to kids and schools and people for preventive action in this specific context? How can we then, which language should we use? What knowledge should we build the pillars on? And that is where I found some comfort in Engeström's theories of cultural historical activity theory. We know it. Others have used it in the libraries and in the schools as well. But what is it? Yes, it is a kind of a tool that can help us analyze some of these some of the processes or some of the issues that we are dealing with. And you have to define your activity system. And in my study, one activity system is the school and the community, the school community as a culture, right? Which is led by the discursive resources we have in the schools, teaching material, planning documents, whatsoever. We have the users, the communities are usually parents and the pupils. It's a certain division of labor, we know, with the district and the province and the schools and whatnot. And there are rules how these things work. What is the rules of schooling? And we all know that. Well, we have to dig a bit to find out the real context, but otherwise we basically know what the school is. What Bernstein called, what is the symbolic control in these systems? It's academic power. That is what counts, right? You have your CV, you have your exams, you have your pass rate, you do things according to what the school expects. So that is where the academic power, that's the power of academic power? But of course the outcome would be mitigating HIV/AIDS. But it didn't communicate with the kids. And it didn't communicate with the teachers even, because they didn't know how to put the words there. And they were not trained. So to make sense of this for a school-based practice didn't reach out to the learners. So what is then the other alternative? The symbolic power here is the spirit power, which relates to indigenous knowledge. Per definition. So it's the spiritual power which is the legitimate power in the families and in the villages and in the communities. And one of the rules is that the norms and the practices is that we shouldn't talk about sex. You shouldn't do it. If you do it, it was not just you that were stigmatized, but your family would be stigmatized, even your kids would be stigmatized. First, secondary, third stigmatization processes. You can read about this as much as we want. So they were all kind of excluded. So how to... And the division of labor was also, of course, organized. The chiefs on top, the headmen, the village headmen, the elderly, they all had their role and their position to organize their inner structure and the rules and the relations of that and the knowledge of that traditional community. So it's not a big thing. Of course, the multi-voiced activities that we conducted was to include the chiefs. They were there from the very beginning, with the school authorities and the teachers and the parents and the students and the smaller ones, to share and discuss issues that they felt were problematic in the mitigation of HIV/AIDS in their context. So, again, what Engeström says, we merge two different activity systems that is representing one, the academic power, the other one, the spiritual power. And all of us have a common object of reducing the infection rate, mitigating HIV/AIDS, but then how do we do that? And the only way to find those things out is to start talking and interact and facilitate and mediate for processes where these things can come out. And then you may say to me, what about the chief in one corner and the lady next to him? What can the lady say? But we didn't do it like that, because we put all the ladies in a small group and they were discussing between themselves and putting it up on a piece of paper and presenting the ladies' views in that gathering. And this pupil did the same. Because when you are with your own homogeneous group, it's very easy to discuss because you feel comfortable. So then you can, after some time, go together and share. Because then you have the strength of having worked with other peers first, right? So that was how we gradually came closer to what I would then call the third space, where we merge some of the scientific knowledge needed to understand the spread. It's not the witchcraft that causes infection. It is actually sexual intercourse, right? But what when you in your traditional community have a practice that say that you are chasing away the witches and the evils by having sexual cleansing? You have become a widow, your husband is dead. The widow is there, she's full of witches, evils. To get them removed, it requires sexual cleansing, because that's a part of the law, that's a part of the system. It's a part of including the widow in the broader collective environment as a safety for also for her, right? It has nothing to do with anything but that. But still we know when 1 out of 5 is infected, what is the risk then for transform the virus? So we could go into lots of practices that had elements of these things and gradually enable people to open up. And that is also how we came from one situation to the other. We have a need state, in this case, sorting out the epidemic. We analyzed the situation, tried to collectively, in a multi-voiced equal setting, discuss and find new ways of working. What did the chiefs do? They say, we abolish sexual cleansing. We go for herbal bath instead. And others would say we do something else, because that was for the chiefs to decide within their own communities. And the same things happens in schools. They do different things. But it's the contradictions that somehow drive the new solution further, right? Because if you were where you go hand in hand, there's nothing to discuss. Huh? But where you have the contradictions, that's where you have to work to negotiate and find out what might the solution be. Between having sexual cleansing, knowing that that is the driver of HIV/AIDS, okay, we have to do something with it. Just one example. So the contradictions, according to Engeström, they can be identified. I'll just take one. Western knowledge, indigenous knowledge, and those dilemmas then that the teachers were facing, where they were supposed to teach according to the curriculum and the plans, but they were still a part of the community. So they were kind of double bound. And these things has to be worked out in a way that help them to do their task also as teachers. And knowing then that the chiefs are the legitimate leaders and they also took part in it, it was somehow a gate opener and a go for the rest of the communities to follow the chief as their biggest model, role model. So, just to make it very simple, the story, from not being able to talk to be able to talk. At least that is a big move. But there are lots of other things. This is a thesis of 300 pages, and you won't get more than a glimpse of it. Good for you, I would say, probably. But the multi-voiced participation is crucial, and also how you mediate it. Because you cannot come and tell people how to solve their own problems. You have to enable people to take part in their own development to solve their own problems. And I think that is also the big challenge now with the SDGs. How do those involved in these processes, how are they able to initiate processes and ways of working that enable people to somehow have a stake in their own development, not being told by others? I would like to see us being told by somebody how to deal with our everyday life. We wouldn't have liked it at all. I think we had rejected like anything. And I think that is a human something. You know, I don't know. Gene. Maybe a human gene. So we need to have a multi-voiced approach and create those spaces for interaction. Right? Where we know that we can have people there. Identify people to take part in these dialogues, which are core people. And the only one who can identify those people are the local people. I couldn't go and say, I need to go to Chief Mukuni. I didn't even know he existed. If I didn't work so closely with my Zambian colleagues, they know how these power structures are if you have a good, trustworthy relationship with them. And remember, it ended up like that. I was there for 10 years. So then together negotiate new solutions in what we can see is in the third expanded space. Not just one place, but in interaction with different stakeholders who know different lenses and ways of working. So, thank you so much. I will just end up with... No, I just wanted to end up with this. This is this small community, Iteshi Tesh, one of the small districts, and they made this big kind of... it's not even a poster. But some had posters in trees. They called it talking trees. Some had measures on stone. They called it talking stones. And some actually managed to display information in different ways based upon what they thought would be feasible and have an impact in their own society. So, thank you.
Thank you, Ellen. I made a mistake. I forgot something very important. And Bob's talk about these contraptions, you know, in our lives made me remember what I was supposed to do. Ellen, thank you so much.
Thank you
for your contribution. And Bob and Ingrid.
I prefer chocolates.
You do. Here is a symbolic gift of appreciation for your contribution. Thank you. And I think that these talks that we've had now before lunch fit very nicely together, actually, you know, about policies and local knowledge, implementation, how these things work out. And I think this feeds nicely into the panel discussion that we'll have towards the end of today. Now we're going to have lunch. We will start again at 1. Lunch is served right outside. And please be back at 1 o'clock so that we'll try to keep time better after lunch. Thank you.